on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. If you think there's nothing quite as dull as watching paint dry, then you've never heard the full reading of a piece of legislation.
Section 10502. Area-based crop insurance coverage.
Senate Democrats have forced a full reading of the 940-page Big Beautiful Budget bill that's been going on since late last night. It'll lead into the Senate debate and a possible vote tomorrow. CBS's Linda Kenyon tells us it's not just Democrats who have doubts about it.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was one of only two Republicans who voted against advancing the bill. He cited deficit spending.
The deficit this year is going to be about $2.2 trillion. My prediction is with all this new spending and with some new tax cuts, that the deficit's going to be bigger next year.
Elon Musk blasted the bill. Posting on X, the former head of the Doge said, quote, "It will destroy millions of jobs in America and cause immense strategic harm to our country," unquote. President Trump wants the bill passed and on his desk by July 4th. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
And we have breaking news out of Washington, where North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis has just announced that he will not run for re-election. Just yesterday, President Trump threatened to support a primary opponent after Tillis voted against advancing the budget bill. The clock is ticking on a TikTok ban in the U.S., but that start date has been pushed back many times. And now the president tells Fox News Futures it could be a moot point soon.
We have a buyer for TikTok, by the way. I think I'll need probably China approval, and I think President Xi will probably do it.
Who's buying?
I'll tell you in about 2 weeks.
Mr. Trump tells the same broadcast that Iran's nuclear program was indeed obliterated by last weekend's U.S. attack. But International Atomic Energy Agency head Rafael Grossi tells CBS's Face the Nation that's not quite true.
The capacities they have are there. They can have, in a matter of months, I would say, a few cascades of centrifuges spinning and producing enriched uranium.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham tells ABC's This Week there's an even bigger issue than that.
It set the program back, I think, a couple of years. But the question for the world, does the regime still desire to make a nuclear weapon? The answer is yes. Do they still desire to destroy Israel and come after us? The answer is yes.
Triple-digit temperatures and heat warnings are the rule in southern Europe and beyond, the BBC's Guy Delaney.
Serbia reported its highest temperature since measurements began in the 19th century, and Slovenia recorded its hottest ever June day. But stepping outside in Skopje was even less advisable. In Croatia, wildfires have been breaking out over the weekend.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. It's nearly the end of June, which is National Pollinator Month. A local agricultural group that aims to empower women in conservation is bringing awareness to prairie restoration and how it can aid the declining population of pollinators. Judith Ruiz Branch with the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Through its Wisconsin Women in Conservation program, the Michael Fields Agriculture Institute is showing how reintroducing native plant species, among other practices, can reestablish these endangered habitats that support an entire ecosystem. Christine Johnson with the Institute says their current focus of pollinating lands and communities is intentional for many reasons.
Besides being a place of empowerment for women in this space, which has traditionally been male-led in focus, we are also reminding folks that conservation is a practice that should persist even as our resources are depleted.
Johnson says a lot of folks in their network want to do this work but lack resources. She says despite DEI and conservation guts to their programming, the Institute will continue to host events throughout the year. Wisconsin Women in Conservation connects women landowners and stewards to conservation initiatives through networking and education. Sally Farrar is a conservation coach for the program and often shares her experience of restoring 13 acres of prairie land using grant funds from the National Resource Conservation Service. She says the first couple of years were not successful, but vividly remembers when things started to click for her.
One summer, there was like hundreds of monarchs, flocks of dragonflies, and the most rare and interesting insects I had ever imagined in my life.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see partly sunny skies for your Sunday with some showers and storms developing, especially the afternoon. Stronger storms producing some damaging winds, some heavy rainfall, highs in the upper 80s, but with the heat index, it'll feel like the middle 90s, southwest winds. It's 84 at our studios.
Maggie Dawn.
Matt Rothschild and Angela Lang step into the host chairs, and they're joined by Tanya Atkinson of Planned Parenthood Wisconsin to discuss Donald Trump's threats to Wisconsinites' health care. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, indeed, my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this special edition of our broadcast, coming to you beginning at 2 o'clock here on Sunday, June 28th. At the outset, I would like to acknowledge and thank the leadership and the management of Civic Media, including my wonderful producer, Max, for their special contributions, their special support to making this special broadcast possible. We have decided, because of the seriousness and the importance of all of these major Supreme Court decisions issued by our High Court in just recent days and weeks, and yes, indeed, in the months even before our current broadcast, to do this special review. Why? Because once again, pursuant to our commission here on Amicus Law Review, to be a friend of the community, to provide information, insight, education, assisting you to make your own judgments and determinations and assessments of your government in action, including in this broadcast, special emphasis upon the judiciary. The third branch of government, Article 3 under the Constitution, plainly, very important in terms of our lives and livelihoods here in 2025 and beyond. And so today, I thank you very much. I'm honored, I'm pleased that you have decided to spend some of your Sunday afternoon in consumption of this additional review and analysis of Supreme Court cases. Those of you who were part of our listening audience yesterday know that we spent most of our time talking about this major decision in Trump versus CASA. That is this major decision authored by Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett, finding that the notion of national or universal injunctions can no longer be supported, that the Judiciary Act of 1789 and every moment since then does not indeed support, does not indeed permit local, federal, district court judges to impose nationwide injunctions. They can still enter injunctive relief. They can still give remedies to particular plaintiffs who are in front of them. They can even entertain class actions, but in fact, they cannot anymore, by virtue of this decision just on Friday of this past week, enter universal injunctions. All sorts of applications and implications from that decision. I encourage you, to the extent that you are specifically interested in knowing more about the content, both of the majority opinion authored by Amy Coney Barrett and also the dissents authored by Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson, to pull up our discussion from just yesterday about that all-important case. It may well be, as history may well tell us, the most important case of this term. Also, as I argued yesterday, a major bookend to the other major opinion issued by our Supreme Court on July 1 of 2024, giving the president a huge amount of aggressive authority to do things not specifically contemplated by the Constitution. Now, as at least the dissenters have indicated, now not providing a federal district court judge or judges around the country the capacity to stop those directives, those executive orders with that newfound power on a universal or national stage. Lots of debate coming out of that particular opinion, and lots of consequences for the ways in which it changes the ways in which we do law in America. We also talked yesterday about two other cases, one of them involving the Affordable Care Act, which was, again, implicitly, if not explicitly, reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. We know about the previous challenges to the Affordable Care Act over time. Just this past week, the Supreme Court upheld a provision of the ACA that requires insurance companies to offer some kinds of preventive care for free, supporting the notion that's a task force designed to determine which kinds of preventive care would fall under the law and which kinds would not, that is legitimate. And therefore, the Affordable Care Act, again, given not new life, but continued life under its structure as established at the time that the Congress passed that legislation. And then we also noted at the end of our time together yesterday, the Supreme Court, disappointing an awful lot of people who thought that there would be a major voting rights decision in the Supreme Court docket. There was such a case, but they decided, as many of the journalists have indicated, to punt on this case. They decided to send off into the next term, that is the term of the court beginning in October of this fall, a decision about whether or not Louisiana's congressional voting map, as designed once and then twice by the legislature, can in fact stand and withstand constitutional muster under the Voting Rights Act. A question about the extent to which race can be used in designing a particular congressional district there in Louisiana, a district that does look the mandering port of this, the salamandering part of gerrymander. It appears that that particular district does partake of that. But the question more centrally and more legally is whether or not decisions made by the legislature to draw two districts, a second district with majority black voters, can in fact stand if that decision is premised upon racial considerations, noting once again that there is about one third of the state's population there in Louisiana is black. That question, the decision on that case, will now have to wait until the next term of the Supreme Court. And in the meantime, the two particular majority black districts in Louisiana stay in place until the Supreme Court once again can address that particular issue. In this special edition, this Sunday edition of Amicus Law Review, we're going to talk about three other cases and spend a good deal of time talking about a free speech case coming out of Texas, about whether or not there can be internet access for adult sites, specifically by youths. That is an issue related to free speech issues under the First Amendment. We'll talk about the court's resolution of that. We'll talk equally controversially about a decision coming out of Maryland about whether or not parents have the right to restrict the access of their young students, their grade school students, prohibiting them from seeing LGBT-related storybooks in schools. Can they opt out for that? The Supreme Court issued a decision on that important case, not only for academics, but also a religion case, since the petition is premised in large part upon religious interests and persuasions coming out of Maryland. And then we're also going to talk about a case involving broadband internet access to poor areas of our nation, rural communities. It's a fairly wonky decision under the FCC. FCC versus Consumers Research is the name of the case. We'll talk a little bit about the legal implications of that. And yes, indeed, a 6-3 decision there that affirms the capacity of the FCC to act and to go ahead in a way that effectively does give life and livelihood to the FCC commission to ensure that communications, and in this particular case, 2025 and beyond, broadband access, internet access is afforded to rural communities and poorer communities
throughout our nation. Before we begin all that, and yes, as I've often said recently, all of this is a lot. We know that the Supreme Court on a regular basis agrees to hear cases and then agrees not to hear other cases. Those decisions typically made by four members of the Supreme Court. That is also a part of the deliberative practice. As you know well, there are quite literally thousands of people every year, thousands of entities every term that seek review by the United States Supreme Court. These cases come from the district courts, from the appellate courts, and yes, indeed, under a constitution. You can also appeal a case from the highest court of a particular state. We have seen that not only in this term of this Supreme Court, but in previous terms as well. All of those courts, those lower courts, generate a lot of work and a lot of decisions. And it's not unusual for both government officials, attorneys general, private litigants, sometimes the Department of Justice, to seek review of those lower court opinions by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in recent years, including this term, has limited its review and has done what's called grant certiorari, granting the writ of certiorari. That's the legal process by which they basically say, yes, send up that lower court docket. Give me that file. Give us a chance to review what you have done. Granting the writ says we will review the lower case decision. Denying the writ says that we will not grant review. And of course, in the great majority, the overwhelming number of cases, the Supreme Court denies review and ends up with somewhere between 60 and 70 cases on a regular basis. No exception this term. They issued about 66 decisions in the end, most of those, not all of them, following oral argument. And we know that along the way, even in recent times, as we have reported here on Amicus, a law review, the Supreme Court has already begun to populate the cases that it will hear in the 2025-2026 term. And that will begin, of course, on the first Monday in October. It has already decided not to hear some cases and to take other cases and put those on its docket. The Louisiana case, for example, is one, again, surprising all of us, not deciding in this term, bumping that, punting that into the next term of the Supreme Court. But along the way, the Supreme Court also making decisions about those cases that it will and will not decide. And so just this past week, the United States Supreme Court issued one ruling in one direction and another ruling in another. The Supreme Court turned away Virginia's appeal just this past week that sought to quash, to stop a challenge to the state's lifetime felon voting ban. Lots of double, triple negatives there to unpack. Two disenfranchised voters claim that the ban violates the Virginia Readmission Act. A little bit of history here. That act is a federal law that set conditions way back when for Virginia to regain congressional representation following the Civil War. Supreme Court saying we're not going to take that up. Lower courts allowed the suit to move forward, saying courts can enforce the Readmission Act and the state doesn't have the immunity that would otherwise attach under the 11th Amendment to the Constitution. But Virginia's Republican-controlled Attorney General's office argued to the justices that they would open the floodgates and make a radical change in the law. Fourth Circuit ruling that the Readmission Act are judicially enforced invites courts to wade into the political decisions that restored the rebel states to federal representation more than 150 years ago. That's what the Attorney General said, calling into question Congress's continuing determination that the states have Republican governments and are entitled to representation. That was the petition to the Supreme Court. And in the end, in a brief order, the Supreme Court had declined to take up the case. A federal district judge is set to hold a bench trial in October on this case. The United States Supreme Court saying, no, we're not going to take that up. Instead, we'll let that case go ahead. It may see the light of day once again, but not probably in this coming term. When we come back, I'll tell you about another case where the Supreme Court said yes, and then we'll move on to those other major cases that were the subject subject of decisions by our United States Supreme Court just in recent times. Stay with us for all of that and more.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns. It's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down. Discover your path to better mental health at HazeldenBettyFord.org/Wisconsin. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great-tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic Sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
From newspaper to radio to magazine to podcast, the way we get our information has grown, and now so has Midday Magazine. Our longtime beloved show has grown to become the Rapids Report. Now exclusively available online, listen at 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, where it's streaming at WFHR.com. Catch up on previous episodes and spread the word. Midday Magazine is now the Rapids Report, streaming weekdays at 4 at WFHR.com and wherever you get your podcasts.
Fear you're missing out when you miss our conversations on air? You can always join the discussion on our social media channels. Find Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find social media for specific shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is a special edition of Amicus Law Review coming to you on Sunday afternoon by virtue of our decision here at Civic Media to spend some time talking with you, hopefully instructing you, giving you some insight into these great numbers of cases decided by our United States Supreme Court. So you've got a sense not only of what they do, but the ways in which those decisions affect our lives on a regular basis. We have spent some time already talking about three of those major cases in our segments that were broadcast just yesterday here on Civic Media. Also reminding us on a regular basis that the Supreme Court will be back in business again next term. That begins on October, the first Monday in October of 2025, continues until this time next year. And once again, next time at this year, a long ways away right now, we will do this once again, reviewing as we often do the content, the substance, the meaning of these decisions as we go ahead. A part of the decisions process, the decisional process by the Supreme Court, is to determine what is going to be on their docket and what is not. Already told you about the decision to turn away this Virginia appeal to this felon voting ban coming out of that state. There's another decision the Supreme Court made also on the same day. They agreed to hear a case of a Rastafarian man who was seeking to sue prison officials for cutting his dreadlocks. An interesting case. Let me tell you about it. Once again, the Supreme Court saying, yes, we will take this on. Supreme Court agreeing to hear the case of this man who's seeking to sue some prison officials in Louisiana who cut off his dreadlocks padlocks while he was incarcerated. The case, again, it's a religious case. It's the latest case involving religious rights to catch the court's attention. And as you know well, as we will reaffirm in this edition of Amicus Law Review, the Supreme Court spends a lot of its time on religious cases in recent terms, including this one, apparently now including next term as well. Could have significant implications for allowing prisoners to sue government officials for damages when their religious rights inside an incarcerative setting are burdened under a federal law that was enacted 25 years ago. The petitioner here, his name is Damon Lander, L-A-N-D-O-R. He's a devout Rastafarian who began serving a five-month prison sentence in 2020 for drug possession. He has taken a religious vow years earlier not to cut his dreadlocks. His situation, undeniably, took a bad turn for him after arriving at the new prison weeks before his release. He handed officials a copy of an appeals court ruling from 2017 that allowed prisoners to have dreadlocks, to continue their incarceration with their hair in that status. The guards, according to the allegations in the complaint, tossed it in the trash. They then handcuffed him to a chair and forcibly shaved his head. Following his release, Lander's release, he sued those prison officials and guards for damages under this decades-old law that protects the religious interests of inmates. The lower courts dismissed this case, ruling the law doesn't allow individuals to pursue these kinds of damages against prison officials for alleged violations of it, even though, according to one of the judges, he had been the victim of a grave legal wrong. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said in unanimous opinion that indeed the case cannot go forward. The Fifth Circuit sort of divided on whether to hear the case. President Bill Clinton, and this is the predicate for all of this, signed a bipartisan law in 2000, year 2000, that protects the religious interests of state prisoners. Not clear whether that law allows people who were harmed to sue for money damages. The Supreme Court in 2020 ruled that a similar law, a similar piece of legislation with nearly identical language, allows people whose religious rights have been burdened to seek damages against government officials in their individual capacity. But the question here is novel for the Supreme Court because of the particular application of this law of 25 years ago. And so the question before the Supreme Court is whether or not he's got a right to sue, to proceed with this. A judgment has not yet been entered. But the question again, is whether or not this particular now released defendant can in fact sue prison officials for cutting his dreadlocks under this major significant religious rights law passed 25 years ago. Let's begin now to talk about some of those decisions, additional decisions that were rendered by the Supreme Court in just recent days. One of them is called Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. And yes, you recognize that name. He is the Attorney General of the state of Texas. You know that well. And so what is this case all about? Well, the Supreme Court on Friday, here's the headline to all of this, rejected a challenge to a Texas law. Again, you've got some double negatives saying no to a challenge that sought to limit minors' access to pornography on the internet. Supreme Court ruling that it does not violate the First Amendment to our Constitution, the federal Constitution, to require people to verify their age through measures like the submission of a government-issued ID before getting internet access. The law plainly was meant to shield minors from sexual materials on the internet by requiring adults to prove that they are at least 18. Again, all of that challenged on First Amendment grounds. Here is the result. Vote was 6-3, right down partisan line once again. And we'll talk about exactly what happened here. The Texas law applies to any commercial website, more than one third of which is sexual material harmful to minors. That's according to the legislation passed by Texas. It does require such sites to use one of several methods. Those are described to verify that users are 18 years or older. It does not allow companies to retain the information that their users submit, which is one of the concerns about the legislation. But the challengers said that adults would be wary of supplying personal information for fear of identity theft, tracking, and extortion. And in many ways, actually in principle ways, this case became about adult access. More than 20 states have enacted similar laws. When we come back, I'll tell you more about what the Supreme Court did in this case. We'll talk about the majority opinion, the dissenters once again, as Amicus Law Review continues here in this special edition.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
CBS News Brief. The Senate is creeping closer to debate and then a vote on the big, beautiful budget bill. CBS's Christiane Benavides.
The bill would extend tax cuts and eliminate some taxes on overtime and tips, while also making cuts to Medicaid and food assistance.
North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis angered President Trump by voting against advancing the bill, and now he says he won't run for re-election next year. Mr. Trump is still claiming the total destruction of Iran's nuclear program by U.S. bombers last week, telling Fox News.
It was obliterated like nobody's ever seen before.
Some nuclear experts say it set back Iran by months, not years. Much of southern Europe feels like a blast furnace. A heat wave has brought temperatures past the 100-degree mark in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Greece. This woman is still having fun in Madrid.
I'm just enjoying it and, like, really loving walking around, being in the shade sometimes, okay. Going for runs.
CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
Another Brewers starting pitcher. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball. Back in April and May, the shorthanded Brewers went through 11 different starting pitchers. In the last week or so, they've unveiled the Miz, Jacob Mizorowski, and his 100-mile-an-hour fastball, making national headlines. Yesterday, the Brewers beat the Rockies 5-0. Right-hander Quinn Priester, allowing just one hit through seven scoreless innings, striking out 11 batters. GM Matt Arnold and the team scouts predicted Priester could become a starter. Pat Murphy says at first he had his doubts.
Matt Arnold in our front office predicting that this was the guy. And when I first saw him, I may remember him a little bit when I saw him in Colorado. And then when I saw him again and the next time he pitched, I'm like, ugh, this is a project. And then 11 more times, our pitching staff, pitching coaches and the players on the staff embraced this guy and allowed him to grow.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Attention, avid readers, if there are still any left. You can never have enough psychological thrillers, as far as I'm concerned, and thanks to Amazon, there is a new one on the way based on a best-selling book. The streamer has purchased rights to Freda McFadden's The Tenant, which has been atop the New York Times bestseller chart for 7 weeks. The story follows Blake Porter, a marketing executive who loses his job and takes in a boarder to help make ends meet. You can imagine how that goes. Tough to find a good roommate, much less one who won't try to kill you. If you haven't been to Summerfest yet, but have been meaning to go, you still have time. One more weekend, to be specific. The third and final weekend of one of the world's biggest music festivals kicks off again this Thursday, July 3rd. This upcoming weekend's music lineup includes Benson Boone, Fountains of Wayne, Social Distortion, John Oates, Without Hall, that doesn't seem right, Everclear, and the Lumineers. Hot fun in the summertime. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but...
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For tonight, scattered showers and storms with a low around 65. For Monday, partly sunny, highs near 80, an afternoon storm possible. Clearing out Monday night with a low around 60 degrees. Sunny and breezy for Tuesday, highs near 80, 82 Wednesday.
Currently, 78 degrees.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Environmental groups say the Midwest grid operator, MISO, is pushing an emergency energy plan that discriminates against wind and solar, the two cheapest ways to produce energy in our state. The plan favors fast-tracking construction of gas-burning power plants at the expense of clean energy projects. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rejected a similar plan from MISO last month, but environmental groups say this one is even worse, with few guardrails to ensure fossil fuel projects are actually needed. Once again, Wisconsin had the biggest wild turkey season in North America. More than 50,000 wild turkeys were harvested in our state this spring. The Department of Natural Resources reintroduced the birds into our ecosystem in 1976 and has been managing the hunt ever since. For a deep dive into Wisconsin's most pressing environmental issues, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Charlie Pittman, Civic Media's news director, will be here to recap all of the weekend news. In hour number two, we lighten it up with We Got This Garden. I hope you can join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. In this special Sunday afternoon edition of our broadcast, continuing to talk with you, engage with you on the sum and substance of these major decisions coming out of the Supreme Court. Yes, they're particular to the parties in front of the courts, including the District Court, the Appeals Court, the Supreme Court, but they have applicability beyond that. And that is certainly true of this case involving the party's Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, who's the Attorney General of Texas. What do we know about this case? Well, we know that Texas, like many states, including about 19 others, prohibits distributing sexually explicit content to children. 2023 is the year that the Texas legislature requires certain commercial websites publishing sexually explicit content that is obscene to minors to verify that visitors are to the sites are 18 years or older. Knowing violations of that law by these providers subjects them to injunctions and also to civil penalties. The petitioners here, who are the representatives of the pornography industry, sued the Texas Attorney General in this case, saying that what the legislature has done cannot stand under First Amendment standards. They're seeking to stop, to enjoin the enforcement of this law as facially unconstitutional under the First Amendment's free speech clause. Specifically, what did they say? They said that adults have a right to access the covered speech and that the statute impermissibly hinders them. Fifth Circuit held that an injunction was not warranted because the petitioners, the challengers, the plaintiffs in this case were unlikely to succeed on these First Amendment claims. The court viewed the legislation as the court said, a regulation of the distribution to minors of materials obscene for minors. And so their focus was on the children. It therefore determined that the law is not subject to any heightened scrutiny under the First Amendment. And that's really how the case plays out. There is no doubt that everyone agrees, again, that states can indeed make limitations on access for non-adults. The question is, does this particular provision overtly and unconstitutionally inhibit adults from getting access to those same sites? And the question presented to the Supreme Court, to the lower court as well, is what level of scrutiny? Should there be a high level of scrutiny because this particular speech should be so heightened, subject to such a heightened standard for protection? Or should there only be an intermediate or lower level scrutiny for analysis of what the legislature has done? In the end, the Supreme Court finds that the legislation coming out of Texas triggers and survives review under only intermediate scrutiny because it only incidentally burdens the protective speech of adults. In other words, the lower standard is applicable here. And because of that, because of the lower standard, the legislation survives. Intermediate scrutiny is the articulated position. And again, important not just for Texas, but for all of these other states that have enacted similar laws. Here's what the majority says. And once again, it's important to recognize that in this particular case, it's Justice Thomas who delivers the opinion of the court. It's his writing from which I'm going to read in part. And it's Chief Justice Roberts and Associate Justices Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, who join in that. You've got Justice Elena Kagan, who files a dissenting opinion. We'll hear a little bit about that as well. Justices Sotomayor and Jackson joined in that dissent. So once again, a 6-3 opinion upholding the Texas legislation. What exactly does Justice Thomas say in the majority opinion? He says, to determine whether a law that regulates speech violates the First Amendment, the court considers both the nature of the burden imposed by the law and the nature of the speech at issue, kind of balancing those two things. Laws that target protected speech based on the communicative content are presumptively unconstitutional and may be justified only if they satisfy strict scrutiny. In other words, you're going to go after content. We're going to analyze these very, very closely. On the other hand, he says, laws that only incidentally burden protected speech are subject to intermediate scrutiny. That is the level at which Justice Thomas and the others in the majority embrace in this case. It goes on to say, laws that restrict only unprotected speech, such as obscenity, receive rational basis review. That's a much lower standard. And as Justice Thomas often says and very much likes reviews of the past, he says that history, tradition, and precedent establish that sexual content that is obscene to minors but not to adults is protected in part and unprotected in part. States may, in fact, prevent minors from accessing such content, but may not prevent adults from doing the same. And goes on then to say, applying those basic principles, goes on to say again, on behalf of the majority, that this particular legislation, it's called HB 1181, has only an incidental, kind of a collateral impact on protected speech, and is therefore only subject to intermediate scrutiny. The First Amendment leaves undisturbed states' traditional power to prevent minors from accessing speech that is obscene from their perspective. That power includes the power to require proof of age, which is what this legislation is all about, before an individual can access that speech. It follows, the justice says, on behalf of the majority, that no person, whether an adult or a child, has a First Amendment right to access such speech without first submitting proof of age. That's the core ruling here. That's a very important piece of what the court finds. Goes on to say the power to verify age is part of the power to prevent children from accessing speech that is obscene to them. Where the Constitution reserves a power to the states, that power includes the ordinary and appropriate means of exercising it. Age verification is common when laws draw age-based lines. Obtaining alcohol, for example, a firearm, for example, or a driver's license. He's using other references to suggest that indeed we can draw those age-based distinctions. Obscenity, Justice Thomas says, is no exception. Most states require age verification for in-person purchases of sexual material, and petitioners concede that in-person requirements of this kind are traditional and almost certainly constitutional. And as a practical matter, he goes on to say, age verification is necessary for an effective prohibition on minors accessing age-inappropriate sexual conduct, content, especially on the internet. In the end, the legislation is supported and the industry representatives lose. The age verification requirements are upheld based upon the fact that the imposition on adults is only incidental, subject to a lower standard of view, and the legislation passes muster. In the end, the court says the statute advances the state's important interest in shielding children from sexually explicit conduct is appropriately tailored because it permits users to verify their ages through established methods of providing government-issued identification and sharing transactional data. The judgment of the Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit, is affirmed. That's what the majority of the Supreme Court says. Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson dissent on that, and they make clear that they're not advocating that that non-adults, that minors should have access, unfettered access, and any access to this kind of material. She begins by saying, in effect, no one doubts that the distribution of sexually explicit speech to children of the sort involved here can cause great harm. Or to say the same thing in legal terms, this is in her dissent, no one doubts that states have a compelling interest in shielding children from speech of that kind. What is more, children have no constitutional right to view it. The Texas statute before us addresses speech understood in First Amendment law as obscene for minors. She makes all of this clear at the very start of her very extensive 23-page dissent. This is Justice Kagan writing. The state can restrict their access without fear of colliding with the Constitution. That's right up front. A trouble, she says, the reason why she's dissenting along with Sotomayor and Jackson is just this. She says the trouble comes in the last two sentences, italics. That is the word they're being used and for minors. She says speech that is obscene for minors is often not so for adults. For them, she says, the category of obscene and therefore unprotected speech is narrower. So adults have a constitutional right to view the very same speech that a state may prohibit for children. And it is a fact of life and also of law that adults and children do not live in hermetically sealed boxes. In preventing children, she goes on to say, from gaining access to obscene for children's speech, states sometimes take measures impeding adults from viewing it too, even though for adults it is constitutionally protected expression. And then she asks this rhetorical question, most appropriately, what then do we do? What then to do? Well, she says, cases raising that question have reached this court on no fewer than four, count them, four prior occasions, and we have given the same answer, consistent with general free speech principles, each and every time. Under these principles, she goes on to say, again, this is the dissent. This is not the law of the case. We talked about that already. The statute still stands. Here is the dissenter saying, under those principles, we apply strict scrutiny, a highly rigorous but not fatal form of constitutional review, to laws regulating protected speech on its content. So there you have it. She's basically saying that while the majority is applying an intermediate level of review, here, because of the implications, this should be a strict scrutiny review. And laws like this particular one coming out of Texas fit this description. She says they impede adults from viewing a class of speech protected for them, even though not for children, once again emphasizing this is not about children, and defined by its content. So when we have confronted these laws before, we have always asked the strict scrutiny question, and here it is the law the least restrictive means of achieving a compelling state interest? There is no reason, she says, to change course here. Goes on to say that what if Texas could do better in this instance? What if it could design this law in some different way? What if Texas could achieve its interest without so interfering with the adults' constitutionally protected rights in viewing the speech that this legislation otherwise cover? She says that is the ultimate question on which the court, the majority, and I disagree. And again, the other two also join in this disagreement. The majority says that Texas may enforce its statute regardless because only intermediate, this lower level of scrutiny, applies. And that test does not ask whether a state has adopted the least speech restrictive means available. I disagree, she says. Based on conventional First Amendment rules and the way we have consistently applied them in every context. The state should therefore be foreclosed from restricting adults' access to protected speech if that is not, in fact, necessary. When we come back, a little bit more about Kagan's dissent and then more about other cases decided by the Supreme Court just recently. All of that on Amicus, a law review.
As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night.
This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day, when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at MDA75.org.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
The Joint Finance Committee was leaked that they intend to cut $87 million from the UW system budget. And so we put this out on our socials last night. And today, the Joint Finance Committee decided to pull that from the agenda. Because apparently, from what I'm told, Republican legislators got a lot of calls. When the truth is disseminated and people react, results can happen.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app. Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
The Trump administration arresting and deporting these supposed gang members without giving them due process is one of the steps to becoming an authoritarian government.
Dale, thank you so much for the call. And again, I second all of that. Bring them all back and afford them the due process that's a part of our nation, a part of this law, and a part of our tradition in administering justice.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org, a message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Your local Civic Media radio station is your source for real news and great conversation, plus fun and exciting contests. For a complete list of contest rules, log on WFHR.com/contest-terms. As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
National Park Foundation, and together with you, we're creating a future where every person, every generation, gets their chance at an unforgettable moment. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review, a special edition coming to you on this Sunday afternoon, talking now about this major case involving the First Amendment. And yes, indeed, sexually explicit materials that are on the internet. The court wrestling with whether or not prohibitions on access by minors also have an untoward and extreme imposition on access for adults. The majority saying, as we have been talking, that under the intermediate scrutiny standard, no problem with this particular legislation, meets the needs of the community, which again, as everybody affirms, ensures that young people, that youth do not have access to any of this material, but does not so infringe the rights of others. Adults in particular, to get access to it. That concern was what prompted, again, members of the plaintiff class to seek to have this overturned. The majority justifying this, again, based upon this intermediate scrutiny approach and saying it passes muster for that reason. The dissenting justices, including Justice Kagan, writing this lengthy opinion saying that, well, again, we agree that adults do have some access here. Plainly, youth, the non-adults do not have any access. The question is, what is the level of scrutiny? And could Texas, could the legislature have designed a statutory scheme that both accomplishes keeping young people and youth away from this without so infringing the rights of the adult plaintiffs here when it comes to information provided about age confirmation? And in the end, she says applying the strict scrutiny standard, which is what she advocates for, does a couple things. She says it's consistent with all the cases we've decided before. And also she speculates that even under that standard, Texas probably could have designed something that does, in fact, meet that standard. Near the end of her very extensive dissent, she describes, for example, the things that Texas might have done. And this, again, is very wonky. And it's very much in the weeds, but it's important to understand what she is saying. She said the majority's opinion, plus some of his footnotes, and yes, indeed, this is one of those situations where footnotes are often important because they sometimes reveal things that give you significant context. So the extent to which you look at this dissent, but most importantly, take a look at the majority opinion here as you assess your own views about who is right and who is wrong here. The footnotes also show why all of this matters. This is Justice Kagan writing. She says, concluding that the legislation passes this constitutional muster, that it's okay, the majority states correctly that under intermediate scrutiny, Texas doesn't have to show that it has selected the least speech restrictive way of accomplishing its goal. And here's where it gets very linguistically complicated, but it's important. Even, she says, if there were a mechanism that one, as well or better, prevented minors' access to covered materials, and two, imposed a lesser burden on adults' ability to view that expression, Texas could spurn that superior method. In other words, if you can craft something that gets everything done, Texas could still say the superior method, go away. Likewise, the majority, because it is applying a more forgiving standard here, she says it compromises our overall First Amendment jurisprudence. Because you're doing that, you can ignore a host of questions about how far the legislation burdens protected expression. In the fine point of these two footnotes, she says, the majority declares that it has no need to explore, number one, whether the legislation requires covered websites to demand age verification for all their content or only for the subset that is obscene for minors. Two, whether the legislation requires that covered speech be obscene only to a minor, including a toddler, or to all minors, including 17-year-olds. And three, whether the legislation permits websites to use newer biometric methods of age verification, like face scans, that pose fewer privacy concerns than submitting government ID and transactional data. Again, that's a lot. But she is proposing there some other methods by which you can accomplish the same things and be subject, therefore, and probably pass muster under the higher level of scrutiny. She goes on to say, the majority explains that even if Texas answered each of those questions in a maximally burdensome way, requiring government ID to view speech that is protected even for children, because one-third of the website's contents are obscene for two-year-olds, the legislation can go forward. And again, she writes, that is true even if Texas has a less burdensome way of equally a more effectively achieving its objective. She's arguing for the alternatives, and she's arguing that even under a higher standard, those alternatives would meet constitutional muster. Here's how she ends her very lengthy 23-page dissent. She says this, if she was in the majority, would demand Texas show more to ensure that it is not undervaluing the interest of free expression. Texas can, of course, take measures to prevent minors from viewing obscene for children's speech. But if a scheme other than this legislation can just as well accomplish that objective and better protect adults' First Amendment freedoms, then Texas should have to adopt it, or at least demonstrate some good reason not to. a state may not care much about safeguarding adults' access to sexually explicit speech. A state may even prefer to curtail those materials for everyone. Many reasonable people, she says, after all, view the speech at issue here as ugly and harmful for any audience. But the First Amendment, she says, protects those sexually explicit materials for every adult. So a state, she says, cannot target that expression, as Texas has here, any more than it is necessary to prevent it from reaching children. Because the majority departs from those views, I dissent, she says. In the end, that's not the law of the case, and the legislation goes forward. When we come back here on Amicus, a Law Review, in our second hour, more of what the Supreme Court has said about life in America. Stay with us for that discussion.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. Crossing President Trump comes with consequences. A day after Trump threatened his political future for voting against his budget bill, North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis says he's done and he won't run for re-election next year. His correspondent Nicole Killian.
Potentially faced a very challenging race. Of course, this comes after he expressed his opposition to the president. So-called big, beautiful bill. In fact, the president has been very vocal on his Truth Social platform over the last 24 hours or so, threatening a primary challenge against Tillis.
As for the bill itself, here's CBS's Christiane Benavides.
The legislation extends tax cuts from President Trump's first term, removes taxes on tips and overtime, and increases spending for defense and border security. Opponents of the bill argue it would make significant cuts to Medicaid and food stamps.